Picture a briefing room at RAF Scampton, May 1943. The crews have been told next to nothing for weeks. They have been doing low-level training runs over English reservoirs in the dark, skimming the water at 60 feet, which is barely twice the height of your average hangar door. They have been doing it so many times that the locals started complaining to the War Office. And now they are in the briefing room. The curtains pull back, and they see the map for the first time. The target is Germany, the Ruhr Valley, the industrial heart of the Third Reich. And the target is not a factory, not a railroad, not a submarine pen. The target is water. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight we are talking about Operation Chastise, and the night 19 Lancaster bombers went to Germany at 60 feet in the dark to drop a weapon that had never been used in combat against dams that the Luftwaffe thought were simply too well defended to worry about. They were wrong about that. Before I get into this, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you have earned it, they have got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the Ruhr Valley in 1943. If you wanted to understand how Germany kept making tanks and artillery shells and aircraft in the middle of a world war, you had to understand the Ruhr steel mills, coal mines, manufacturing plants, stretched across the valley in such concentration that by some estimates it was producing over half of Germany's war materials, and all of it depended on water, enormous quantities of water, for cooling, for steam, for processing. The valley was fed by a system of reservoirs held back by massive masonry dams. The Moni Dam, the Eder Dam, the Sorp Dam, structures so large and so solid they seemed as permanent as the hills themselves. Barnes Wallace looked at those dams and thought, what if they weren't? Wallace was an engineer. A brilliant, precise, sometimes infuriating man who had already given the Royal Air Force the Wellesley and the Wellington bomber, aircraft built around his geodesic construction method. During the war, he had been studying what it would take to destroy a large dam. The math was stubborn. A conventional bomb could not do it. The dam face was too thick, and weapons of any reasonable size would hit the water and be absorbed, or glance off the masonry and fall away. You needed a weapon that could travel through water, press itself against the base of the dam and detonate there. The hydrostatic pressure would do the rest. But getting a bomb to the base of a dam underwater, against a fortified structure with torpedo nets strung in front of it, was a problem nobody had solved. Wallace solved it by making the bomb bounce. The idea sounds almost ridiculous until you watch it work. The bomb was cylindrical, about 5 feet long, spun backward before release, so that backspin stabilized it as it skipped across the surface of the reservoir like a flat stone thrown sidearm. Each skip carried it across the water, and the backspin meant that when it finally hit the dam face and sank, it kept rolling down the masonry underwater, pressed against the face all the way to the base, where it detonated at a precisely calculated depth. Elegant, genuinely elegant. But it required conditions so specific that Wallace himself was not sure it could be achieved in combat. The bomb had to be dropped from exactly 60 feet, not 55. Not 65, 60, from an aircraft flying at 220 miles per hour from a range of exactly 450 yards from the dam face, at night against targets defended by searchlights and anti-aircraft guns in modified Lancaster bombers at an altitude that would put their wings barely 30 feet above the water. 60 feet at night over a black reservoir is not a comfortable place to be. The Royal Air Force did not advertise that this was going to be a difficult job. They rarely do. What they did was pull together some of the most experienced bomber crews available, form them into a new unit, and give them to a 24-year-old wing commander named Guy Gibson. Gibson was already a combat veteran in a war where many veterans were already dead. He had flown nearly 170 bombing sorties. He held the Distinguished Service Order with a bar and the Distinguished Flying Cross with a bar. He was 24 years old. He was the kind of man who, when he finally got called off combat operations, volunteered for one more mission, and then volunteered again. 617 Squadron formed in March of 1943 at Scampton in Lincolnshire. The crews were told very little, they trained constantly. Night after night, low-level runs over English reservoirs, until 60 feet felt natural in their hands and feet without looking at the altimeter. Which was good, because conventional radar altimeters of the period were not accurate enough for this kind of work. So the engineers came up with a solution that is remarkable in its simplicity. They mounted spotlights under the nose and under the tail of each Lancaster, angled so the beams converged on the surface at exactly 60 feet. When the flight engineer looked down and saw the two spots touching on the water below, they were on altitude. You are flying at 220 miles per hour in the dark over a German reservoir with guns going off all around you. and you're holding altitude by watching two flashlight beams on the water. The range problem they solved with a wooden triangle, a simple sight, two pegs that measured distances corresponding to the gap between the dam's sluice towers, which were known dimensions. When the towers aligned with the pegs, you were at 450 yards. Release. The Lancasters themselves were modified extensively. The bomb doors came off entirely, because the upkeep bomb, as it was officially designated, was too large to fit inside the bomb bay. It hung in an exposed cradle below the fuselage, driven by an auxiliary motor, spinning at 500 revolutions. Per minute before release, the whole aircraft vibrated slightly. These were not standard Lancasters. There were 19 of them. That was all there were. The night of May 16th into the 17th, 1943.
The weather held. The moon was up, which was necessary for the attack and also meant the German gunners could see them. Gibson briefed his crews in the afternoon. The targets were the Monet, the Eater, and the Sorb. The attack force was divided into three waves. Gibson would lead the first wave of 9 aircraft against the Monet. If the Monet was breached, the surviving aircraft would move to the Eater. A second wave of 5 aircraft would fly independently to attack the Sorb. A third wave of 5 was held as a mobile reserve. They began crossing the English coast at around 9:30 in the evening, flying low across the channel to get under the German radar, then east across occupied Europe at treetop height. Navigation at 60 feet in the dark over hostile territory by moonlight. No radar, limited radio, a thin line on a map, and the ability to read rivers and railways from the cockpit of a Lancaster doing 220 miles per hour in the dark. 2 aircraft were lost before Germany. One struck a power line over the Netherlands and went down with all its crew. Another hit the sea on the outbound leg and had to turn back. Now here is where it gets interesting. Gibson brought his wave to the Monet just before 12:30. The reservoir glinted in the moonlight. The dam, a massive stone wall 750 feet long and over 100 feet thick at the base, sat at the far end. Torpedo nets in front of it, anti-aircraft emplacements flanking the towers. And the moment they descended to bombing altitude, the searchlights came on and the guns opened up. Gibson made the first run himself. He came down to 60 feet, watched the spots converge on the water below, held his airspeed at 220, aligned the pegs on the towers, and released. The upkeep bomb skipped across the surface, hit the dam face, sank. The explosion sent a column of water 200 feet into the air. The dam held.
One bomb was not enough. Wallace had calculated it would take multiple strikes in the same area to build sufficient hydrostatic pressure. Gibson called in the second aircraft, and then to give his crews the best possible chance of placing their bombs accurately, he did something that is still remarkable to read about. He flew alongside each attacking aircraft during its run, drawing anti-aircraft fire onto his own machine, using his Lancaster as a deliberate distraction. At 24 years old, with 170 sorties behind him, he positioned himself alongside each crew during the most dangerous 30 seconds of the entire approach and invited the guns to track him instead of them. The third aircraft was hit on the run-in. Pilot Officer Hopgood managed to release his bomb, but it bounced over the dam and detonated on the far side. His Lancaster was on fire. He held it long enough for 2 of his crew to bail out. Then it went down. Hopgood was killed. 5 of his crew died with him. The 4th run placed the bomb well. The 5th run. By the time the 5th bomb detonated, the crews watching from above reported something that none of them forgot. The dam face seemed to tremble. Gibson called in the 6th aircraft. And as the 6th bomb detonated, the Monet gave way. 100 million tons of water began moving through a breach 250 feet wide and over 100 feet deep. The flood was visible from the cockpits of the remaining Lancasters. It moved through the darkness below them like something alive, spreading across the valley floor, taking everything with it. Gibson transmitted the code word for success back to group headquarters. The word was the name of his Black Labrador, a dog he had owned for years, who had been killed by a car on the airfield that same afternoon while Gibson was briefing his crews. The irony is not something anyone who knows the story can easily set aside. The surviving aircraft turned toward the Eater.
The Eater was a different problem. The reservoir sat in a narrow, winding valley, hills on all sides. And the only approach was a curving descent through a gap in the hills that left almost no room for a Lancaster to level off at attack altitude before reaching the dam face. The crews made practice pass after practice pass in the dark, threading the gap, getting level, watching the spots, aligning the pegs. All in about 40 seconds of flying. On one approach attempt, a crew descended too steeply and had to apply full power and pull up hard to miss the hillside on the far side of the dam. They came back and tried again.
It took 3 aircraft and multiple passes. The Eater was breached just before 2 in the morning. The Sorb Dam was never breached, its construction was different, an earthen embankment rather than masonry, and the bouncing bomb was not effective against it. Several crews dropped their weapons on it. The Sorb held, it still stands today. The losses on the way home were severe. Aircraft that had survived the dams were caught by anti-aircraft fire and night fighters on the return leg. By the time the last Lancaster landed at Scampton in the early morning, 8 of the 19 aircraft that had taken off were gone, 53 aircrew killed, 3 taken prisoner, in one night. From a squadron that had been in existence for less than 3 months, Barnes Wallace was at Scampton when the aircraft returned. He had championed this weapon through years of skepticism and official resistance, argued for it when senior officers thought he was wasting everyone's time, and now he stood on the airfield counting the aircraft that did not come back. He reportedly broke down completely. He told Gibson he never meant for men to be killed, and Gibson, who had barely slept and had just watched his squadron lose more than a third of its crews, told him no one could have done more. Guy Gibson received the Victoria Cross. 53 other crew members received decorations of various kinds. The raid was front-page news across the Allied world. The RAF had demonstrated that German infrastructure was reachable in ways the enemy had not fully calculated.
The military impact was real, but debated. The flooding disrupted Ruhr production through that summer. The repairs to the Mone and Eder dams required something in the range of 12,000 German workers and months of engineering effort. But the dams were repaired. Germany was more resilient than strategic bombing planners often assumed. What was harder to measure was what the raid did to morale, on both sides. The British public saw that precision was possible, that the RAF could identify a specific target, develop a specific weapon, train specifically to use it, and execute in a single night against everything the enemy could put up. The German High Command learned that structures as massive and permanent as the Ruhr dams could, in one night, simply stop existing. 617 Squadron kept flying. They became the RAF's precision attack unit for the remainder of the war. The outfit that got the impossible jobs, they dropped the Tallboy bomb, a 12,000-pound deep penetrating weapon that Wallace developed next. They attacked the Tirpitz. They went after the V-weapon sites in France. They became the squadron you called when ordinary bombing could not reach the target. Gibson was not with them for most of it. He was pulled from combat operations after the dam's raid, too valuable as a symbol to risk losing on a routine mission. He wrote his memoir, published in 1944, and then flew one more operation that September, a light raid that should have been straightforward. His de Havilland Mosquito was found crashed in the Netherlands 2 days later. The cause was never determined. He was 26 years old. The Avro Lancaster deserves a moment here. 4 Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, the same engine that drove the Spitfire and the Hurricane, each producing around 1,500 horsepower in this application. Wingspan of 102 feet, loaded weight of over 60,000 pounds, and Gibson's crews flew it at 60 feet, at night, over a hostile reservoir, while trying to watch 2 flashlight beams converge on the water below them and keep a wooden sight aligned on towers they were approaching at 220 miles per hour.
The crews were not supermen. They were mostly in their early 20s. Some of them had never flown a combat mission before training with 617 Squadron began. What they had was the preparation and a wing commander who flew alongside them in the flak, instead of leading from a safe orbit above. There is something about this story that I keep coming back to. And it is not the technical ingenuity, though that is real. It is not the courage, though that is obviously real. It is the specificity of it. 60 feet, 220 miles per hour, 450 yards, 2 spotlights on the water, a wooden triangle with 2 pegs. Aviation has always been like that. The margin between making it and not making it is usually a very specific number that somebody figured out in advance. And your job in the cockpit is to hit it. Gibson's crews hit it, again and again, in the dark against everything the Germans had. And the dams came down. The history here draws on Guy Gibson's memoir, Enemy Coast Ahead, the records of the Royal Air Force Museum, and the detailed accounts assembled by historians of the strategic bombing campaign over Germany. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dregger. Take care of each other out there.